Up next, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Nonviolence is the Most Powerful Weapon. He is interviewed by Martin Ogronsky in 1957.
Gandhi, Dr. King, dramatized and defined the technique of nonviolence, and yet he also said that the only alternative to fear is violence, and that if that were the alternative, he would have to choose violence. Do you subscribe to that judgment of Gandhi, or would you disavow violence under any condition?
Well, I think I would have to somewhat interpret Gandhi at this point. I don't think he was setting forth violence as an alternative. I think he was emphasizing, or rather trying to refute an all-too-prevalent fallacy, and that is that the persons who use the method of nonviolence are actually the weak persons. Persons who don't have the weapons of violence, persons who are afraid. And I think that is what Gandhi was attempting to refute. Now, in that instance, I would agree with Gandhi that if the only alternative to violence, is violence and vice versa, then I would say fight. But it isn't the only alternative. And that is the one point that Gandhi was trying to bring out. It seems to me that there are three ways that oppressed people can deal with their oppression.
What are they, Dr. King?
Well, one is to rise up in open violence, in physical violence. And some persons have used that method, persons who have been oppressed. But I think the danger of that method is its futility. I feel that violence creates many more social problems than it solves.
May I interrupt you there, Dr. King? There are today certainly people who are forced to endure a kind of injustice that neither you nor even Gandhi in his time had ever seen. For example, would you regard the martyrs of Hungary's rebellion a year ago as misguided men and having used violence?
I admire freedom fighters wherever they are, but I still believe that nonviolence is the strongest approach. I think that would apply to the Hungarian situation also. I don't think it's limited to a particular locality. I think it should apply in every situation in the world where individuals seek to break loose from the bondage of colonialism or from some totalitarian regime or from the system which we confront in America.
You truly believe then that nonviolence is the sole, the universal answer to injustice and oppression?
Very definitely. Very definitely. I feel that nonviolence, organized nonviolent resistance is the most powerful weapon that oppressed people can use in breaking loose from the bondage of oppression. Now, the other method that one might use is that of resignation or acquiescence. But I think that is just as bad as violence, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good.
You make a difference, a distinction between passive resistance and non-violent resistance, is that it?
Well, I think that can be something of a semantical problem. If passive resistance means just passively accepting violence or injustice, if it means cowardice and stagnant passivity, then there is a difference, because nonviolent resistance does resist. It is dynamically active. It is passive physically, but it is strongly active spiritually.
In a sense, would you regard it as moving into the Christian philosophy too? You mean the doctrine of turn the other cheek to regard as positive rather than passive?
I think it is positive. I think very definitely, if it is used properly and accepted with the proper attitude, it is a very strong method. It is a method of the strong man, not the weak man.
Dr. King, the editor of the local newspaper here proposed an editorial the other day that I ask you to reconcile, as he put it, your passive resistance philosophy with your satisfaction, which you've expressed very clearly, over the use of bayonet force in the Little Rock situation. Well, I'll put that question to you. What is your answer to this editor, sir?
Well, I might say that I did back the president in his action in Little Rock, Arkansas. I think it is quite regrettable and unfortunate that young high high school students have to go to school under the protection of federal troops. But I think it is even more unfortunate that a public official, through irresponsible actions, leaves the President of the United States with no other alternative. So I did back the President, and I sent him a telegram commending him. Now, your main question is, and the question of
the editor
of our local newspaper here, is how does this jibe with my whole philosophy of nonviolence?
How does it?
I believe firmly in nonviolence, as I have already said. But at the same time, I am not an anarchist. Now, some pacifists are anarchists, following Tolstoy. But I don't go that far. I believe in the intelligent use of police force. I think one who believes in nonviolence must recognize the dimensions of evil within human nature. And there is a danger that one can indulge in a sort of superficial optimism, thinking man is all good. Man does not only have the greater capacity for goodness, but there is also the potential for evil. And I think of that throughout my whole philosophy, and I try to be realistic at that point. So that I believe in the intelligent use of police force. And I think that is all we have in Little Rock. It's not an army fighting against a nation or a race of people. It is just police force seeking to enforce the law of the land.
And this would be your answer to the editor. To explore another facet of the Little Rock situation, are you satisfied with President Eisenhower's performance on the racial issue?
Well, I guess to answer that question, I would need to make a general statement. That is that the Negro has been betrayed at many points by both political parties. I don't want to make this a party situation. I don't think either party can boast of having clean hands in this area. It is my conviction that both parties have failed to take the strong stand in the area of civil rights that they could take.
Having called down a plague on the houses of both parties, are you satisfied with President Eisenhower's performance in this particular situation, Dr. King?
Well, with the Little Rock situation, yes. I think the president should be commended for the positive and forthright stand that he is now taking in the area of civil rights in general and in the situation in Little Rock, Arkansas in particular.
But you are dissatisfied with the overall performance of both the president's party and of the Democratic Party.
Oh, yes. I think both parties could improve, and I think both parties must come to the point that they see the moral issues involved rather than making a political football out of the civil rights issue.
The implication being you think they still are doing that.
At points, yes.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. We're returning to Jimmy Carter. President Jimmy Carter is the founder of the Carter Center and a recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
We just finished our 93rd troubled election in Sierra Leone. And in that Mono River Basin area of Western Africa, which includes also Cote d'Ivoire and Guinea and Liberia, it's just a typical place. As the Arab Spring or Arab Awakening took place, the Carter Center has been there. We've been in Egypt for 2 years as Egypt struggles to form a new government. And I'll be going back very shortly again. We did the election in Tunisia. We did the election in Libya. We did the first election in the biggest Muslim country on earth, Indonesia, following 50 years of dictatorship. So we try to bring freedom and democracy there to those countries as they struggle for freedom and democracy. We also work on health care, the sharing of what we have with poor people. One of the basic principles of the Carter Center is to fill vacuums in the world. And over a period of time, our budget, we started out just trying to promote peace between countries or peace between the United States and other countries, shifted toward democracy, which we originated, the monitoring of election, and then primarily to treating five what the World Health Organization calls neglected tropical diseases. One of these is a disease called onchocerciasis or rubber blindness. I just came back from Mexico this week. I was down there because we have almost completely completely eliminated river blindness from Latin American countries. We just have one little tribe of 24,000 members totally that has any more oncocercosis or river blindness, and that will be eliminated within the next 2 years. We won't have any river blindness left in Latin America. We get free medicine from major pharmaceutical companies like Merck and Company. They give us free medicine to treat river blindness. Last year, we treated 12.8 million people with free medicine from Merck and Company. We distributed a total of 160 million doses of Mectizan, they call it. We also have dealt with trachoma, which is the number one cause of blindness, except for cataracts. We've administered 75 million cases of free Zithromax, which is an antibiotic. And we performed, the Carter Center last year performed 40% of the total surgeries on Earth for trachoma. Trachoma is a disease caused by filthy eyes, where flies get around children's eyes and adults' eyes and cause infection. And the upper eyelid turns inward, so every time you blink your eye, the eyelashes slash the cornea, and that causes blindness. We also have built in Africa, encourage the people to build 2.3 latrines, outdoor toilets. I'm not known in Africa as the one who brought peace between Israel and Egypt. I'm known as the person who builds the most latrines on earth. Guinea worm is another case. Guinea worm is caused by drinking filthy water from a rain pond where it doesn't rain but just 2 or 3 months a year. And the people get a worm inside their body, which 12 months later is about 30 to 36 inches long. And it stings the inside of the epidermis and causes a terrible infection that destroys muscle tissue. We found nobody else wanted to deal with this disease because it affects isolated villages in the desert areas and also in the jungle areas. And we decided to take it on. We found 3.5 million cases in 20 countries, 3 in Asia and the rest of them in sub-Saharan Africa. 26,500 villages had guinea worm. We've been to every village. And we've taught the people what to do so they won't have the disease. We've reduced now 3.5 million cases. Last year, we had 542 cases on Earth. And within a couple of years, we'll have our last case of guinea worm, which will be in South Sudan, which is a new nation that we helped form by monitoring their elections and letting them have a referendum. So this is the kind of thing that just a small NGO will do. I didn't come here to brag about what we are doing, but I came to point out that these are apparently intransigent problems that our country faces and that every one of you individually faces and I face are not insoluble. If we set our goals high, and are determined to work in harmony with each other, no matter what our social status or what our political alienation or affiliation might be, to work in harmony in this great country. This is what we need to assess. In closing my remarks so I can answer your questions, let me just say that I believe that all of us would agree that our country, the United States of America, should be a champion of peace. We should be a champion of justice. We should be a champion of human rights. We should be a champion of environment. We should be a champion of alleviating suffering among other people on earth. This is what I think are the challenges of a superpower. Thank you.
Our thanks to President Jimmy Carter. I'm Skip Rhodes, past chair of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors and your moderator for today's audience question period. President Carter, we have a huge number of questions.
I see that. Yeah.
So let's begin.
Do I get to choose the ones I want?
If you'd like. Let's start with a couple of questions I'm going to roll together concerning the nuclear situation in North Korea and Iran. Is the situation dangerous? How does it contrast North Korea versus the Iranian nuclear situation? And why does the U.S. have no clout when it comes to influencing settlement policy?
By settlement policy, you're still talking about the nuclear thing.
Nuclear.
Not settlements in the West Bank.
Yeah.
Okay, but just want to be sure. Well, I think there's a very close parallelism between Iran and North Korea. I've been going to North Korea quite regularly since 1994 when we were on the verge of a war between North and South Korea, and I went over and negotiated with Kim Il-sung, and then President Clinton followed up and had an agreement in all issues, including no nuclear program in North Korea, that was consummated in Geneva a little bit later on. Unfortunately, when George W. Bush became president, he threw that agreement in the wastebasket. And at that time, North Korea, who is very paranoid and very isolated, as you know, and very dominated by dictatorship, decided that they would go all out to defend themselves by creating nuclear capability. The first thing that they did was to purify spent nuclear rods from inside two very small power plants that I knew about then. The world knew about it. And they agreed not to do that anymore. But that's the way you make plutonium, and that's what they have now. It's probably the capability of 4 or 5 or 6 plutonium bombs. They just exploded another one, as you know, this past month. We don't know if it was purified uranium, which takes a lot longer, or just the plutonium made out of spent fuel. So I think that the North Koreans are going to have a good enough judgment not to be suicidal, because they know that if they ever use a nuclear weapon against South Korea or anywhere else, that the United States will wipe them off the map, because we have 5,000 very advanced nuclear weapons. I think the same thing exists in Iran. My hope is that we can prevent Iran from developing a nuclear weapon, and I'm not sure at this point, and no one else is either, that Iran leaders have decided to go with a nuclear capability, that is a nuclear bomb capability. They have now purified their uranium in centrifuges. They have thousands of them, up to about 20% of pure U-235, which is the explosive component of uranium. Most of it is 238, which is not explosive. And so this is something that's a challenge for us. And so my hope is that we can negotiate with them. There was a deal worked out between Brazil and Turkey and Iran earlier that said that they could go up to 20%. Iran agreed to say okay, and they would let the international inspectors come in. So far, the United States has never offered Iran to lift all the economic sanctions if they would agree on limiting their nuclear capability to 20% and letting the IAEA, the inspection, come in and see about them. But even if Iran should develop, this is the worst case, and I hope it doesn't happen, if they should develop 2 or 3 nuclear weapons, then they know that if they should challenge Israel, for instance, with one of their nuclear weapons, Israel has, 200 nuclear weapons of a very advanced nature. We have 5,000, and I'm not sure that the Iranians are suicidal enough to want to have their own country wiped off the map by challenging Israel. So my own preference is that we negotiate with Iran and negotiate with North Korea as well, because we have not been willing to even talk to North Korea for a number of years. There's been not a single day of talks with North Korea since President Obama has been in office. I've been there twice since then. But what they want is to have a peace treaty with the United States. So far, we just have a ceasefire between the United States and North Korea, left over from the end of the nuclear war 60 years ago. So there's a lot of parallelism between them. I don't believe either one of those countries is going to be suicidal enough to use nuclear weapons. I hope we can prevent their nuclear weapons by good faith talks with both countries.
Thank you. Mr. President, this questioner asks, first off, I am a supporter of your views on the Middle East policy, but I have no definite answer on what prevents real progress in the Israel-Arab conflict. What is Israel's position? What is the Arabs' one? And why, again, does the U.S. have no clout when it comes to influencing Israeli settlement policy? And the final question, whose fault is most significant?
Uh-oh. Well, as I said in my talks, this is the first time since Israel has been a nation that the United States has, you might say, zero influence either in Jerusalem or among the Palestinians. And I'm very grieved about that, and hope that this upcoming visit by John Kerry, the new Secretary of State, to Israel, and then followed up by the first visit by President Obama to Israel, will be meaningful. After he was first elected president, President Obama went to Cairo, as you may know, and called for zero settlements, in increase in the Israeli settlements in Palestine. And he also called for later that the 67 borders around Israel, modified by good faith talks, would be the prevailing premise for peace. That is generally called by a two-state solution, with Israel living within its borders, modified slightly, and with the Palestinians living within their borders in the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem, side by side with mutual respect and in peace. That's what everybody hopes for. My own belief, with which many of you may disagree, is that Prime Minister Netanyahu, for the first time, has decided on a one-state solution, because under his administration, Israel has been madly building settlements in East Jerusalem and also all the West Bank. Nobody wants Gaza. And this means that it's becoming decreasingly viable, or likely, that you can have a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel. And so I'm very discouraged about that, and the only thing that can be done about it is for the United States to play a major role. And if President Obama will go back to the two premises that he had earlier, no more Israeli settlements in Palestine, and the 67 borders would prevail between the two, modified to accommodate the large settlements that's right outside of Jerusalem, then that would be the best solution. I think the Arab world will accept this. On two or three occasions already, every Arab country, in fact, every Muslim country, even including Iran, has agreed that that is a premise that they will accept, and that they will recognize Israel equal to all the Arab countries with trade, commerce, and diplomatic relations. But so far, that has not been possible. And I don't think the Israelis are going to do it unless the United States plays a very strong role. I met with some Israeli leaders last week at the Carter Center who came to visit me. They believe that if President Obama goes to Israel and makes that strong call for a two-state solution based on what I've just said twice, that the 60% at least of Israeli citizens will agree with him. I think the recent election in Israel showed that Prime Minister Netanyahu had gone too far along the road toward ending the possibility for a two-state solution. It's a very complex situation. I fumbled through my answer, but I've written two or three books about the subject. Maybe you can buy one of my books, and then you can get the answers.
Still staying in the Middle East, please comment on Egypt. What are your expectations for their government and the relationship of Egypt with the United States?
Well, I know Egypt quite well. In fact, when the Carter Center has been in Egypt, that I mentioned in my earlier talk, for 2 years, and I'll be going back again for the fourth time to see Egypt overcome 50-something years of dictatorship and move in a fumbling way toward honest and free and fair elections. There have been three elections so far for the parliament and for president, and every one of them has been honest and fair. That is, they have accurately expressed the will of the people who went to the polls and voted. As you know, the Muslim Brotherhood prevailed and came in first in both the parliament and also the presidential election, but that's not hard to comprehend because 90% of the people in Egypt are Muslims. And you couldn't expect the 10% of the Coptic Christians, for instance, to prevail. And my own belief is that the Muslim Brotherhood and the elected president, Mohamed Morsi, are moderate in comparison with some of the other extremes. I know President Morsi quite well. He's an engineer. He was educated here in California, Southern Cal. That's where he got his Ph.D. in engineering. When I first met him, he was a dean of the engineering school in Cairo, and he had no idea that he would ever be running for president. But the way things happened, he did run because some other candidates were disqualified. I think he's struggling to bring about a moderate government in Egypt because it's to Egyptians' benefit to be accepted as a moderate government, respecting human rights and so forth, by the rest of the world if they want to have trade, commerce, tourism, and so forth. So this is a very, very difficult issue. They have fumbled. They finally have a constitution. It's not perfect, but it's a constitution. And he just took office in May or June, and they got a constitution in December. A lot of us in this audience might say, well, they should have done better than that. But it took the United States 12 years to get a constitution. After we declared our independence in 1776, it was 12 years later before we finally had our constitution approved. I think we have to be patient with them.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Heard about the enemy, now I wanna get me some. See the choppers in. everyone to smithereens.
More from great speeches and interviews after these messages.